This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It is now my great honor to introduce Dr. Mary Lyons, President of the University of San Diego, to welcome you to tonight's panel. Dr. Lyons.
Thank you, Leanne, and good evening, everyone. I'm so very honored to be with you this evening, not only to offer a welcome on behalf of our university to those of you who are our guests and from the community, but also to say how wonderful it is to see so many of our own students, faculty, and staff here for this important panel and exhibit also. You know, I've had a great love affair with the continent of Africa since my childhood when, as a youngster, I lived in Asmara, Eritrea for a few years. At a time when there was relative peace, and I say that, you know, relative, because the Emperor Haile Selassie still kept a kind of iron hand on both Eritrea and Ethiopia at the time. But I was there also at a time when we call it the Suez Crisis of 1956 was unfolding, and classmates of mine were refugees from Morocco and other countries in northern Africa. I've been able to go back to Africa several times since then, but one of the most moving and quite stirring experiences for me was only a couple of years ago when I was hosted by Catholic Relief Services with three other university presidents to visit Rwanda and Burundi, hosted so that we would have an experience of the important work that is being done to effect as much reconciliation as possible among an amazing population of men and women who have suffered grievously and yet who are, in my opinion, among the most courageous on this planet in working toward what seems unfathomable to most of us, and that is reconciliation. The photographs in the exhibit that I witnessed just a little while ago captured, I think, so well in the faces of the men and women who are captured by these wonderful photographic artists, the quality of that courage. I can remember so well being in a large assembly in a village not too far outside of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, where a group of men and women from the village assembled to tell their stories to us, the visitors. The local Catholic priest himself from Rwanda, living in the same simple and very, very impoverished condition as his people, had been working with representatives from Caritas International and Catholic Relief Services to bring about reconciliation among members of that community that had been torn apart, but what yet remained very, very interdependent. A gentleman stood up and gave witness to the atrocities that he perpetrated, the prison term he spent, and the efforts he was making to seek forgiveness of those around him. And after his heart-wrenching story, the woman next to him stood up, told her story of suffering, the members of her family who had been killed, and looked at the gentleman next to her, who was in fact the perpetrator, the one who actually had killed so many of her families. And they embraced. They had been reconciled after many, many attempts, many efforts, great resistance on her part, you can understand that. But unbelievably, they had found a way to live together in peace. If you have ever had the opportunity, and I hope some of you will, to visit this marvelous country and have a chance to visit the Genocide Museum, you would notice something that I found very striking. And that is, this is a museum that not only pays homage to the victims of genocide in and around this part of Central East Africa, it reminds us all that occasions as horrific as these are, have happened long before the 1990s in Rwanda. The museum depicts the genocides that have happened around the world and, in fact, are still happening. It is for that reason, but not that reason alone, that we are here tonight. But it is also why we are here in this wonderful school of peace studies, why the university has committed itself to having programs that provide men and women the opportunity to study how best to take their intellectual gifts and their passion and their compassion to work toward communities that will sometimes, hopefully, be free of all of the hatred and all of the discord that can lead to such horrific acts as genocide. I'm very, very honored that we have students from our master's degree in peace study, which is now over a decade old, led by Dr. Otto, whom you met just a moment ago. And we also have students who are seeking a minor in their undergraduate studies in peace and justice. Would those of you who are students here at our university kindly stand so you can be recognized? Thank you. In some cases, these are men and women who are rather recent to the field, and others who have been out working in the field, working hard, and have come back for some, perhaps, rest as well as intellectual stimulation, because there is so much to learn still. And that's why we have a school. The School of Peace Studies, along with our Transborder Institute and the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice, have now for some years been committed to doing everything possible through the wonderful research and scholarship of its faculty, as well as the education of the students and the community members who come here, to learn what more can we do to help those men and women throughout the world develop communities that are sustainable, economically viable, free of violence, and also committed to not just the peace of their own communities, but around the world. That's part of our mission. It's a big part of our mission. And it is a very, very important part of why we're here tonight. So for that, I'm very grateful that you join us in this mission. One of our esteemed faculty members will be moderating the panel tonight, and I would like now to introduce the moderator, Professor, Assistant Professor Dustin Sharp, who is a specialist in all of the areas about which I've spoken. His particular research right now is on transitional justice, something that Rwandans and those in Burundi are also working toward mightily. Professor Sharp, before coming to us, was with the United States State Department and worked also for Human Rights Watch. An experienced attorney, he understands the rule of law and, more importantly, probably understands what happens when there is no effective rule of law. So with that, would you please join me in welcoming Professor Sharp to the podium? Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Otto, and thank you, President Lyons. As President Lyons mentioned, I teach and write in a field that's known as transitional justice, and I actually see some of my students out there that are taking the class this semester. No compulsion at all involved in getting them here. But transitional justice is a field of study that takes a comparative look at how societies reckon with the legal, moral, and political dilemmas responding to mass atrocities. So we start with the Jewish Holocaust in World War II. We can look at the killing fields of Cambodia. And we can look at tonight's subject, Rwanda, to look at its similarities. Well, 20 years ago this spring, between 500,000 and 1 million Rwandans were slaughtered in little over 100 days, as the world looked on, for the most part, in mute witness. And that violence was swift, it was public, it was participatory, it was well organized. And these were not hidden in gas chambers behind concentration camp walls. was one of the most horrific world historical events of the 20th century. And tiny Rwanda has come to cast a very long shadow in the years that have followed. So Rwandan history and the roots of the genocide are, of course, complex and contested, and I can't even pretend to be able to do them justice. And we could start with colonial history, and we could look at how Belgian policies helped to strengthen a sense of difference and division between historic groups, historic identities known as Tutsi and Hutu. We could look at the Rwandan Civil War that began in 1990 between the Hutu-led government and the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was a rebel group largely consisting of Tutsis who were based in neighboring Uganda, who had fled Rwanda earlier based on earlier pogroms against the Tutsis. Those two sides had just signed a power-sharing agreement in 1993 that did not sit well with Hutu conservatives who were promoting a racial supremacist ideology of Hutu power that reviled Tutsis as outsiders. And of course, we could also start on April 16, 1994, when the plane carrying the Rwandan and Burundian presidents was shot down on its descent into Kigali, killing all the passengers and being the most, most immediate trigger of the genocide, which started on the very next day. The thing to remember, I mean, all of these sort of narratives are contested. The thing to remember about the Rwandan genocide is that nothing about it was inevitable. The Rwandan genocide, like all genocides, was planned and orchestrated at the highest levels of government. It was calculated. So when you look back at some of the rhetoric from the mid-90s that looked at Rwanda, that looked at Bosnia and talked about upwellings of ancient tribal hatreds, as if there were some kind of volcano or tsunami that we can't predict and just happens. It was nothing like that at all. Major international powers, including the United States, were aware that something like this might take place. They could see the planning. They could see the handwriting on the wall, and yet they did nothing to stop it when it did happen. And they did nothing even to mitigate it. Even things as simple as radio jamming for the hate speech that was being aired over the radio were not done. The Clinton administration famously, of course, would not even acknowledge that genocide was going on, only referring to acts of genocide, which, of course, resulted in the famous quip, how many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide, to which the State Department didn't have an answer. But the testimonies from the genocide perpetrators have made clear since then that that ambivalence and that withdrawal on the part of the international community was interpreted as a tacit sign of approval, and it gave encouragement to those who were laboring in Rwanda's killing fields. In the two decades that have followed that genocide, those 100 days, the world has paid a very, very heavy price for its failure to do more, because the effects of the genocide weren't limited to tiny Rwanda. They sent shockwaves across the entire subregion and sowed the seeds for the war in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo that's killed upwards of 5 million people and which continues on until this day. So in some sense, the Rwandan conflict that started in 1990 has not ended. It's just actually moved the theater of combat. So the world is right to be ashamed, and Clinton and other world leaders have apologized, have expressed regret. But one of the questions for us tonight is, have we really learned anything in spite of those admissions of regret? After the Jewish Holocaust in World War II, the refrain was, of course, never again. And after Argentina's dirty war, the report of the Truth Commission, the Sabato Commission, was entitled Nunca Más, Never Again. Of course, that refrain was heard again after Rwanda in the early 90s, never again. And yet, even as we sit here, slaughter and forced starvation of civilians in Syria continues unabated. And so I think when you look at these patterns over time, you can sort of ask yourself, well, what does never again really mean? Maybe it's really only until the next time. So responding to the aftermath of mass atrocity really strains, especially on a Rwandan scale or a Cambodian scale, strains the moral imagination. And shortly after the genocide, the United Nations Security Council established the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And over the last 20 years, they've convicted nearly 30 individuals, and many of them the chief architects of the genocide. France recently, for example, which has long been accused of harboring suspected genocidaire, has actually convicted Rwanda's former intelligence chief for his involvement in the genocide in their national courts. So those are important legal developments, even if to some people they seem pretty tokenistic in comparison to the scale of what actually happened. So again, it strains the moral imagination. How do you begin to respond to something on that scale? For its part, the Rwandan government has taken very significant steps to punish the perpetrators, to try to forge a new sense of national unity, and to rebuild. As many as 2 million individuals, according to the Rwandan government, have been put on trial. It'd be the most people anywhere in the world has ever been put on trial at one time, using a community-based courts that are loosely rooted in a tradition known as Gacaca. But of course, those efforts by Rwanda have not been without controversy. So significantly, war crimes committed by the ruling party, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, have not been subject to much scrutiny, and that has led to accusations of victor's justice. Political opponents of the regime have often been labeled divisionists or as having a genocidal ideology in an effort to quash dissent and free speech. So if Rwanda is at peace today, many would say that it's an autocratic peace, where obedience to authority is paramount. And that culture of obedience is very worrisome to many people, those, especially those who know the history of the genocide and how it was actually carried out. Still, the new government is ambitious, it's innovative. Post-genocide, Rwanda has achieved remarkable economic growth, about 8% per year. It's, if you go to Kigali, it's orderly, it's relatively secure, it's clean. No black plastic bags that seem to mar most of the African capitals on the rest of the continent. So if Rwanda's authoritarianism has a dark side, it can neither can its remarkable achievements be denied. And this has led to very complex questions about what it means to strike the right balance between liberal democracy and respect for human rights on the one hand and the felt imperatives of development and security on the other. So much of the legacy of the Rwandan genocide is going to depend on how Rwandans use important freedoms like freedom of speech to grapple with historical complexity. And unlike many other post-conflict countries that my students study, Rwanda did not establish an official truth commission or fact-finding body to try to come up with some national narrative or definitive history. If you look at Rwandan schools, for at least 10 years after the genocide, they simply stopped teaching Rwandan history in schools altogether, took American history, European history, but not Rwandan history, because it was too controversial. And that's worrisome in a country where a large percentage of the population has been born in the last 20 years. It has no memory of the genocide. But of course, Rwandans aren't the only ones who need to remember. And so part of what we're here to say tonight is that whether never again actually means anything is going to depend upon how the world comes to understand the events of the genocide, including its own failures, its own complacency, and in some cases, even a certain form of complicity. So, we're here as part of a worldwide effort. This is not the only genocide commemoration going on in the world. To try to preserve memory, to commemorate, to extrapolate policies, to extrapolate lessons learned for going forward about the Rwandan genocide and how they can be applied today. What more can and should be done to build peace and prevent mass atrocities going forward? And, we've had the privilege of seeing a lot of amazing speakers, a lot of amazing panels that come to this theater, but the cast of characters we have today is really one of the most varied and interesting I've seen, and I think that you're in for a real treat. So starting with the order of presentation, we're going to start with Dida Nibagwire, who's a theater actress and playwright who began her career in 2007 in a play called Never Again Rwanda, and has since been in numerous plays and films. And she's going to bring to us a very important perspective, not just as a genocide survivor, but also as a peace builder who uses the arts to promote reconciliation, forgiveness, and respect for human rights. Daniel Bekele is the executive director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and he oversees a global staff and supervisors research and advocacy efforts in the Great Lakes of Africa and everywhere else on the continent. He has a master's in legal studies from Oxford University and is completing a PhD in Oxford as well. Next up, we have Eugène Gattari, who is a former Fulbright Scholar and Gandhi Fellow and an alum of our master's program here in this building. So it's amazing to see the program's old enough now to have one of our alums who's now actually gone out and has enough experience to come back and share that with us all. Gattari has been chief of party for a USAID peacebuilding project in Rwanda. He's advised the government of Rwanda on programs relating to governance, reconciliation, and accountability. And he's currently a student at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Next, we have Philip Lancaster, who spent the last 20 years working in Africa and is a world-recognized expert on conflict in the Great Lakes region. After serving as an assistant to General Romeo Dallaire, if any of you read the book Shake Hands with the Devil, that name might sound familiar to you, He went on to work for UNICEF in Sudan, Uganda, Burundi, and has served as the director for the Disarmament and Demobilization Program in the Congo. I guess there's still some work to be done there. And he's now adjunct professor and senior researcher of the University of Victoria, Canada. Finally, we're going to have Paige Sawyer, who's a writer and journalist for 15 years before turning back to her love, the visual arts and photography. And she's recently returned from a three-month trip to Rwanda, where she was working with a group of young female photojournalists. And she's in the process of launching a project with the Global Press Institute to bring photography education to over 130 women reporters around the world. So with that, I will turn things over to Dita. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Dita, as said, and it's written here. I'm an actress. I use theater for advocacy and education. I've been doing that for since 2006. It started as a personal journey. I'm 27 years old, which means I was 7 years old in 94. Many will think I'm 18, I look young. Even my mother, she looked young, even if she had 10 kids, she looked 20. I was born in a small village in the south of southern province of Rwanda, in a family of 10 children, and in a beautiful village. I don't have so much memory of it. That's the hard part of the life. I just remember running, seeing everyone being killed, and when you're a kid and you're 7, you don't know what's going on. It's just being in a horror movie, and you didn't expect that. My family was killed. My parent, my mother, my father, and my, there are many, I can't even be able to count them, my five siblings. I remember have the image of people coming to kill my mother, and they had a whole discussion because no one wanted to kill her. Apparently, she was very kind to them. She used to give them milk, and everyone was like, I can't kill her. And the other one was like, I can't kill her. And finally, one of them killed her, and she didn't completely die, but I always feel like I should at least remember what she was saying. But my sister, she was older than I. She does, but she doesn't like talking about it so much. Since then, when we lost most of them, I had to run with my sister. We spent night in bushes. She would go steal food at night for us. And people tried to help us, but it was not easy. Some people were not able to risk their life for others. And we ended up in the small city, still in the southern province, to this man who was a vice mayor, I think. He's now sentenced to life, but his daughter went to the same school as my sister. She tried to hide us, but his father said no. He said he doesn't cockroach in his house, and she took us to another place. And it's crazy how people are. They didn't want to kill us. The place we were, they were saying that they haven't finished their own people. We should wait to be killed. But I think my sister was tired of hiding, running. She was like, we stay here, we die, or we don't die. Finally, they decided they were going to kill us, and they took us into this hole. They throw us in a big hole with the other dead people. It was really very deep. There was this man who was still alive. And my sister recently, she told me that I asked her if we were dead because I haven't seen a dead body before, and they didn't know how to die was. But when they throw there and they closed, and I asked her if we were dead, and she said, no, maybe go out of here. And that girl knew that they throw us in, and she had to go pay the killer to take us out. It's also interesting how when you listen to all survivors' story, there is always a good Hutu person who's behind their story. It's not, that's why we shouldn't say, oh, the Hutu killed the Tutsi. The extremist Hutu killed Tutsi, but they're always that good person who rescued people. From then, a friend of hers took us to hide us, and he took my sister to his mother and me to his brother-in-law. And his brother-in-law, he had like 10 kids, and he wrote my name, his identity, and said I was his last born because I was the same age with his last daughter. And that's when it was the end of the 100 days, and RPF was taking the country, and everyone was fleeing to Congo. Everyone was exiling to Congo. I didn't know where they were going. People were going. I live in the house. I went with them. We walked, I don't know how long it took us to get to Bukavu, but it was days and days. We spent night on the road. And we got to Congo. I lived there a year in the camp. Life was not easy there. There was still hard, people had still ideology. I was telling Phil how they used to tell us that the Tutsi rebels, they were animals, they had tail. And the only person I would think who was in the country was my sister. And I would always sit somewhere and imagine my sister living with animals, with tails. They show us monkeys on the road. We passed the national park. Now, and they were like, the RPF are like those animals. They had this teaching that people believed. And for me as a kid, I believed it. I couldn't imagine how my sister lived in that country. I find that man really protected me. Sometimes they would want to kill me. They would say that if I go back to Rwanda, I would say they in Congo. But he would always say, she's a kid, she can't say anything, she will stay with us. And when it became very bad, he tried and sent me back to Rwanda in 95. My auntie survived, my mother's young sister, so I went to live with her. Leaving home was easy because there were so many orphans. We were many. We had joy at the house. And when I went to boarding school, that's where many young people, when you're 12, you mostly go to boarding school because it's public and cheaper. That's where I started thinking more about it. My friend would talk about their parent, and I started also thinking about mine. The only image I could get is them being killed. And I had that period that I would always sit somewhere and cry and don't get an explanation. I would even think about it and I couldn't understand it. I would always be like, why this? Why did it happen? Why me? Why not the others? It was a very difficult period for me, but I started writing. That's, I don't know if I had an artistic part in me, but I think that's how it came. I started writing to my mother, and I would always tell her everything, how I'm doing, and I would tell her to greet my siblings and my father. It helped me a lot, and I would hide my notebook under my mattress so no one would see it. But also, I created something in me that I should find something that makes me happy. I started creating comedy play in at school and trained my friends and we perform. When I finished high school, I met these young people. They were doing theater for reconciliation and forgiveness. It was in an NGO called Never Again. I haven't thought much about what I wanted to do or who I wanted to be because it was too much for me to think who I want to become because there's always that thing that comes. And you even hate life. At some point, feel like, I don't even want to live. Why even living? We started the process of writing a play on reconciliation. It was an intermarriage between Hutu and Tutsi, and we wrote a very nice play, and the director was Ugandan, and he asked us, do you really believe in what you've already wrote? And we were about 13 young people from different backgrounds. I was like, no, I can't marry a Hutu. And he's, why do you give the message? Those who can do it, I want to teach people, but if they're able to do it, they can do it. And he told us that first it's between us. Let's talk about things. And we started talking among us, and everyone had a story, even a worse than mine. And others saw that we all recognize that we all have a story. You can be a survivor. You can be their kids who have their parent in prison for life. And everyone who see them in the village, they see them in their father's image. He's a killer. But as someone who was my age, that person's not a killer. So it was kind of thinking outside of me and seeing more of an open way. What is the society? If I had that in me and I felt maybe it's only me, about me, or maybe only people in my house, but I started thinking about how about the other people I meet around. So we started performing and having debate with people, and it doesn't ask a lot. People need someone to listen to them. We would perform and spend 3 or 4 hours listening to testimony. That's only what people need to feel free and to feel that they're breaking the barrier. Even some who insult us, like, you're just coming us to tell us to marry each other. Why? Take your message away. But at least they said it. Yeah, it has been a long journey and not easy. And it helped me a lot to realize that out of that deep darkness, you can find a small light and follow it, and also help the others, and they help you and each other. You can all together, you can move forward, and we are trying. 20 years is not enough. It's recent. When you think about it, it feels like it was yesterday. But even if it's hard, it's still possible. Something can be done, and people can learn and learn from it and make steps and make changes. Recently, we talked about changing the world. Sometimes you wake up, you feel like, I'm going to change the world. But you can't change the whole world yourself. Do the little you can and impact your neighbors, everyone around you, and all those little things all the people around you do and what you do can change the world. Yeah, I think that's what I have to say.
Everyone in Rwanda has different stories, many stories, and not so good stories. When I left this place after my program, my Peace and Justice program, 10 years ago, I thought I was going to apply everything I had learned from the course, from the program. But the first thing I did was to unlearn everything I learned from here. So my first work was working with the local government organizations. It was a program in conjunction with the USAID and the Office of the Ombudsman. So the biggest task they had was to put in place an anti-corruption strategy. Corruption, I've moved several years from where DIDA stopped. I had, before I came to USD, I had worked in Rwanda from 1995, and I was working in education sector, in governance and conflict management, mainly working with the civil society organizations in collaboration with government.
My work was to engage the government to make reforms, to put in place policies and programs that should help the people to get back on their feet. So the main target was to address the key areas that had facilitated the genocide in the first place. So, and it's mainly from those experiences that I want to briefly talk about what works, what doesn't work, and what needs to be done. I had prepared to say that in 30 minutes, but I have 7 minutes. And I think I have 5 minutes now. I shall try to condense it as much as I can, and probably we shall respond to questions during the Q&A session. The first move to make sure that there was a semblance of human decency and relationship was the Gacaca courts you've heard about. I won't go into details of that, but I want to say that it was the first step towards a homegrown traditional system, deliberately adopted to make sure that everybody was included. So these are traditional systems that people understand, that they live with, they have lived with them before, but they are more modified. So the Gacaca courts were established in every village, on every hill. The process of reconciling people who killed relatives and friends, spouses, children, was a difficult one. But it was an inevitable one at the same time. What I can say is that Gacaca achieved a lot in 6 years. Within a period of 6 years, 1.965 million cases had been processed. Some people were sent to jail for life. Those who confessed for what they did and came out and showed the survivors where they buried their relatives, they were given short sentences and they were processed through short-term arrangements, and they came out. But what I want to say about the Gacaca process, that was a government policy, but the actual work, the actual details of how it worked was mainly done by the young generation, the youth, the generation of DIDA. One of the programs which I managed, funded by USAID, was targeting the youth and helping them to take a leadership role within the community. And the leadership role was aimed at bringing the two different communities together, although they were already living together, but aimed at trying to make sure that they can sit together and talk, not in a general level, not in a general level like that we are in general Gacaca courts, but this time it's real, they are living together, that's after the trials, and they have to sort out some other disputes that might arise after that. So the youth, they used a lot of methods. Drama is one of what Dida has said. Intermarriages. You can imagine marrying from a family whose father killed your mother. That's a difficult one. But the youth said, we have to move on. We have to make a step and move forward. Another thing that has worked with lessons from which we can learn was I'm trying to think, it's in Kinyarwanda. Most of these traditional systems are in Kinyarwanda, and they are meant to really involve people so that they own them. So one of them is there's a program aimed at reducing poverty and creating wealth. It's called Jiringha, meaning have a cow. A cow is a sacred animal in our culture. So, but very quickly, what I can say, my time is over. What I can say about that program is that every poor family was given a cow. And the cow was not meant for one person. The cow would be shared by another member of the community, and the chain would continue like that. But the results from that are so amazing that by December last year, milk and milk products from that program have contributed to Rwanda's national economy, and they have earned more than $22 million. And that program, the products of that program, have surpassed foreign exchange income formerly brought in by coffee and tea. And this is a program that has really included almost everybody. They have profited in terms of improving their health from the products, and they have also profited in terms of gaining personal incomes for their families. And they have been connected to the international market. And this international market for this product is basically within the region: Tanzania, DRC, Burundi, and Uganda. I thank you for listening to me.
My name is Daniel. I work for Human Rights Watch, and just wanted to clarify because Dustin introduced us in a reverse order. So that's Eugene Gattari, who just spoke, and I am Daniel Bakala, working for Human Rights Watch. I would like to begin by saying a huge thank you for University of San Diego and the Crokin Institute for organizing this event and having us to speak on this panel. The Rwandan genocide, as you heard, is really one of the most terrifying episodes of targeted ethnic violence and ethnic killing at such a huge, huge scale. And the speed at which it was executed and the planning that went into it is indescribable. So first and foremost, this being the 20 years anniversary of the genocide, it is a moment to remember the victims. It's a moment to reflect on the sufferings and pains of the victims and what Rwanda has gone through, just in the same way as the story Dida has shared. And thank you so much for sharing that story, Dida. I think my contribution would be a reflection on progress, the progress that has been made in terms of delivering justice over the past 20 years by way of reflecting on lessons learned. And I guess what I would be doing would be perhaps expounding on what Dustin has touched on and what Eugene has just mentioned. I think this is an opportune moment to reflect progress made and lessons learned, and whether or not the response of the international community for such mass atrocities has changed in any meaningful way. On the question of justice, I think it would be very important to begin by recognizing that in the aftermath of the genocide, the Rwandan government faced quite an exceptional, quite an enormous challenge of delivering justice in such a wide number of cases. And, you know, the traditional way of using the conventional courts was hugely challenging. It would have overwhelmed any judiciary, any court system anywhere in the world. But then, you know, the judges and many of the judicial officers of the Rwandan court were themselves skilled, so there were not a lot of legal professionals. So it was quite an exceptional kind of challenge. So the Rwandan government has really embarked on this unprecedented and quite a very ambitious program of combining the conventional courts together with a traditional dispute settlement mechanism called the Gacaca courts, which Eugene has explained very well. It was quite an ambitious undertaking, and indeed the Gacaca court process, together with the national court's prosecution, has achieved a significant progress in terms of holding perpetrators to account. Quite a number of, you know, it is, as Eugene has just mentioned, it is close to 2 million cases that have been processed by the Gacaca court, and the speed at which these cases were processed by the Gacaca court is quite remarkable, and the way the Gacaca court has functioned involved the participation of communities, so it was useful and had a lot of positive sides to it. But I think it's also important that to note that there were limitations to it as well. You know, this is not a proper court system, and understandably, it did not. It was not really in a position to guarantee fair trial standards. And as a result, particularly at the initial years of the process, there have been really a number of cases in which innocent people have been wrongly arrested, wrongly charged, and wrongly convicted. There was a system put in place to review such incidents. But it unfortunately did not work effectively, and we have been observing how the Gacaca courts were performing, and it is I think it's important to note that in that sense it kind of leaves a little bit of a mixed legacy. It has achieved quite a lot, and perhaps there was no other alternative to process such a huge number of cases other than such an ambitious project. But it had inherent limitations in it. It was just lay judges, and in some cases the system was vulnerable to corruption, abuses, manipulation, and there have been cases of innocent people having been wrongly convicted in the Gacaca process. But this does not mean it would diminish the historical significance of this experiment. But I think there is still chance to establish a proper review mechanism and system to make sure that at least some of the most worrying wrong convictions can be corrected. That's one point I wanted to make about the Gacaca court. The trial process of the perpetrators involved in the genocide process was happening not only at Gacaca courts level, although many of the cases were processed by the Gacaca courts. Prosecutions were happening at various levels, as I'm sure many of you here would know. There was an International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which has handled a certain number of cases, only selected number of cases. And then, in addition to the Gacaca courts, the Rwandan conventional courts have also processed several thousands of cases. There were thousands and thousands of cases that were brought before the courts and processed by the courts. And then there are a certain number of cases that were brought before foreign courts. A number of the perpetrators have since then fled Rwanda, and some are residing in several places in Africa, in Europe, in the US, and in a lot of places. So there have been cases that were brought before foreign courts, and some have led to convictions of the perpetrators. But I think I would say that while the progress that has been achieved so far is quite a significant one, there are still a good number of perpetrators of this terrible crime that remain at large, including in several European countries, including in the United States. So I think there is still work that needs to be done in terms of apprehending and bringing perpetrators to justice and extradition to places where they could be tried in fair and fair trial processes. One other limitation in this process was the fact that Dustin has mentioned this very briefly. The genocide was the terrible part of the story, but another atrocity or massacre that has happened in Rwanda at the time is a massacre committed by the forces that defeated the genocidaires. This is basically the at the time the rebel movement that defeated the government in power at the time was fighting a war against the genocidaires that successfully toppled down the government. But when a number of people fled into particularly into eastern Congo, which at the time was Zaire, that has led into quite a terrible massacre of civilians. It does not in any way amount to the genocide committed by the Hutu extremists, but some of it might amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity, and so far there has not been a prosecution for that crime. On the Rwanda side, there was an admission of that that violations, and certain number of cases have been prosecuted. The International Tribunal, the ICTR in particular, has not prosecuted even a single case from that category. But I think that remains to be one of the worrying concerns on delivering justice for the atrocities that happened during that period. I guess I have totally run over my time, so I will shut up here. And
I'd like to thank Dustin for mentioning one of the string of failures that I've been involved in over the last 20 years. But there's a good side to this. If we are meant to learn from failure, then I must be one of the best instructed people on the planet. I took my second trip to Africa wearing a uniform and carrying a gun, and I landed on the 8th of May of 1994 at a run out the back of a Canadian Hercules aircraft. that didn't come to a full stop. I was greeted by General Dallaire and a few other old Army, Canadian Army friends who'd preceded me against the flow of fleeing Belgian and Bangladeshi troops. You may remember that in the early days of the genocide, the Security Council withdrew the mission against the wishes of General Dallaire, and in fact, Dallaire refused to leave, but lost all of his staff-trained officers, his well-trained staff officers, and the Canadian government volunteered to replace the losses. I was among the fortunate few. Many things stand out from those days. But I'd like to share with you a story, a very vivid memory that somehow won't leave, that may help explain the point I'd like to eventually get to in the time that I have. We were near the end of June. At that time, the total UN mission was about 400, half of us armed and the other half not, by UN mandate, because they were military observers, they were not allowed to carry weapons. With those small forces, we'd managed to set up a couple of protected areas, one in the Amahoro Stadium, where there were approximately 30,000 people crammed in unspeakable conditions, but relatively safe. And General Dallaire had decided, because of the pace of killings in the rest of the country, that maybe we could save a few more if we could take some of the Hutu from among that group and trade them for Tutsis at risk in other parts of the country. Seemed logical. We set it up. Over the course of the next 5 or 6 days, the convoy coming from one direction or the other would be shot at by one side or both, until General Dallaire lost his temper. And if you've ever seen his films, Roy Dupuy, who plays him, does a pretty good job of portraying this irascible French-Canadian who would fly off the handle really interestingly. But he thumped the desk and warned the liaison officers from both sides that he was going to be at this crossroads where the convoys would generally meet the next day, and he was going to tell the world who fired and who messed up the operation. Well, I was the general's office boy, so I thought, well, this is a good opportunity coming. I can get some paperwork done. And you can imagine my enthusiasm the next day when I found myself swept up into this little catastrophe. We ended up standing at the crossroads with 20 mil going one way and 50 cal going the other. And the day got very crazy, but that's another story. We managed to get several hundred Hutu going one way and several hundred Tutsi back into a safe, protected area. And we thought we'd done well. At the end of the day, the two Canadian officers who'd escorted the Hutu people back came into the office looking desperately in need of a drink. So I opened my last bottle of scotch and got them into my office and heard their story and got the rest of the boys in to listen to it blow by blow. And it turned out that the count had been off, so the way the Interahamwe decided to straighten out the accounts was to kill 12 people in front of my two Canadian friends. And after what had happened over and over and over again, this was just too much. Well, we went through it, and the two officers, one a young French-Canadian from the Royal 22e Regiment, who said, you know, I can understand what's happening. I can get my mind around all of it, but what I don't understand is why us? Why are we here? The other fellow was this long-in-the-tooth Newfoundlander who'd been around the block a few times. He took a drag of his cigarette, and he looked up, and he said, son, there is no one else, just us. Just us. And at that point in time, it all came clear. If you look at the structure of decision-making around that moment in time, the international community, the collective decisions in each of the nations that could have done something but chose not to, it was just us. Today, we see similar sorts of problems going on and a similar, rather impressive capacity to look away, to not respond, to not take seriously problems that are happening too far away or in an area that we're not interested in. And if we ask people today on those missions, we get the same answer, just them. Each one feeling like they'd been put there and abandoned, not supported. Today, United Nations peacekeeping missions don't have contributions, troop contributions, from first world nations. There just aren't any. It's been contracted out, in a manner of speaking, to nations with large armies and different traditions. If you look today at missions like MONUSCO in Congo, you find that there's a brigade of Indian and a brigade of Pakistani troops, good soldiers. But they come without diplomatic support in Kinshasa, the capital of Congo. They come without first world media that could keep the world's attention focused on the problem. They also come with some other baggage that I don't want to go into. But the mission in South Sudan, these sorts of missions require us, but this time a larger us. The group of people who see a problem and want to do something about it and are not content to sit and let someone else do it. And I throw it as my last statement here that we have a problem. We have a serious problem in that the nations of the world today seem to have forgotten why we invented the United Nations. What we have now doesn't work. We know that. But we also know that we need it to work. And if it's going to be made to work, it comes back to us. Thank you.
So I moved to Rwanda in early 2012 with my husband and with my two kids. And I went there to teach a photography class to adolescent girls. And as I do before I go to most countries, I read a fair amount about Rwanda so I could understand a little bit about its history. But I intentionally tried not to go with the focus on that particular part of history, Rwanda. I didn't want to go looking at everything I did there through the lens of the genocide. And it was easy when I first got there. I had to get my kids into school. It was just like moving anywhere, kind of getting settled in and started teaching, had an amazing group of girls in my class, loved it. Beautiful country if you've been to Rwanda, rolling green hills. And if you were to go there today and you didn't know what had happened all the 20 years ago, you wouldn't know. And as I began to work, it's probably about a month into being there, I started to allow myself to kind of think a little more about what had happened there. It was then 18 years ago. I made a lot of wonderful friends there, but one of the people I became closest to was my translator in class. He's sitting down at the end of the table, who you've met, Miss Dita. And we became very good friends. And when I wasn't teaching, I started to go out on my own and do my own photography work. And I knew from the beginning I wanted to get to know my students and I wanted to document their lives. So I started going home with them, going to school with them, going to church, wanted to just learn more about what it was like to be a young person in Rwanda. And so Dita was with me. And it was during one of those shoots at one of my students' houses that, and I'll never forget this moment, that I said to her, just like you'd say to any friend, so tell me a little bit about your family. How many siblings do you have? And there was just this pause. And I just knew. I was like, oh boy. And you know, at that moment, and in the rest of the time I spent in Rwanda, the genocide was no longer this far away humanitarian crisis. It was became personal to me. Here was someone who I loved, and this was her life. This was her story. This was not. And I think that's the most important thing to me, whether it's Rwanda, whether it's many of the other humanitarian crises. There's so many personal stories, and I think a lot of the commemorations going on are so important because it gives people a chance to tell their personal stories. This was not one event. This was many, many people who whose lives were changed forever. So I tried to imagine, you know, I started allowing myself to see some of the undercurrents that I could then see were there in the people's in people's lives, and even though it wasn't on the surface, even though, like I said, if you went there today, it wouldn't jump out at you. You do start to see some of the tensions that are still there, and some of the wounds people carry. And I started to want to understand what this was like. And you know, in particular, I would look at Dita, who was 7 at the time, and when we lived there, my daughters were, I think, 7 and 9, and I thought. And she became very close with my daughters. They're very close now. And I would see her with my daughter and think, I can't imagine that. I can't imagine her having to go through that. And then I look at Rwandans now, whether it's Dita or the other people, and they are so strong. I mean, there's such a light and such a positivity. And I'm just blown away by that. And I have learned so much about the strength of the human spirit. To go on, to forgive. I honestly don't know that I could forgive the way so many people there have, the way they've been willing to reconcile. And I know that, you know, people will say it was their only choice, but it's pretty extraordinary. And they have my utmost respect and admiration for that. It's taught me a lot about myself and what people are capable of. And you know, I'm pleased, too, to be able to represent the photographers who are in the exhibit. I hope you've had a chance to see it. Photography, for me, is a way to try to understand things. It's a way to try to see and explore. It allows me to enter people's lives and to tell their stories. Teaching photography, which I kind of got into accidentally, but I love it, and gives me the chance to teach other people to tell their own stories, which ends up in many cases being even more rewarding for me. One of the other things that I'm doing now is I'm a photojournalism trainer and photo editor for an organization called Global Press Institute, which if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check it out. And, you know, that's what we do. We empower women journalists around the world to tell their own stories from their communities. We feel like they're the best people to tell their stories. And so teaching them photography and seeing them tell their stories is very, very rewarding. We have a desk in Rwanda. And that desk in particular holds a very special place in my heart. I plan to go back, not only for that job, but to go back and continue my personal work, continuing to tell stories of Rwandans. You know, I think the arts in particular are just a really great way, especially for young generations, whether it's photography. There's some art galleries there that some young people in Dita's generation have started. And I think it's just been a great way for them to learn to heal, to process, you know, as they continue to try to move forward and come to grips with their past. And but I have a lot of hope for Rwanda. There's still a lot of things they have, a lot of struggles, but I look forward to continuing to go back and continuing to tell their stories, and hopefully I can continue to share pictures and the stories that I bring back.
Great. Well, I really wanted to thank all of the panelists for sharing their stories and wisdom. And I think if the panel illustrates anything, it's that the work of peace building and atrocity prevention is the work of many hands. It's the work of photojournalists. It's the work of the UN. It's the work of international civil society, of artists, of local civil society, of national governments, working at all of those different levels. I started off with my comments about mass atrocity straining the imagination and not knowing where to begin, and often where to begin, you just begin with where you are and what you can do. And that's something that everyone has done in their own way. And it's, you know, the work of many hands. We need more hands doing the work. There's a heck of a lot more money still going into militaries, for example, than conflict prevention and peace building. And peace building is very, you know, if you think genocide prevention is costly, look at the money that we've spent on refugee assistance, on peace building, on DDR, on security sector reform, and all these efforts in Rwanda and the DRC in the last 20 years. Even if you're not sort of in the field doing the work, we need more hands creating pressure on governments to give more money and to care more about doing peace building and doing conflict prevention. So there's a fairly famous story during the genocide when Human Rights Watch went in to meet with the National Security Advisor at the time, Anthony Lake, and said, you know what's happening in Rwanda? And he said, yeah, I'm very well aware. Well, can you do something about it? And he said, well, I'd love to do something about it. But until the White House, until American congressmen, senators start getting calls from the public to put pressure on them to do something, I can't do anything about it. The Clinton administration is gun high. We've just had Black Hawk down in Somalia. Unless you make me do it, it's not going to happen. And the reality was the public pressure wasn't there, right? So it's easy just to sort of blame Clinton or to blame whoever, but we also need publics to care about these things. And that's, you know, one of the changes we maybe seen in the last 20 years in terms of mobilization of college kids, mobilization of publics around issues in Darfur, the DRC, County 2012, with all its problems, and elsewhere. And to not end on a pessimistic note, I mean, I think, you know, it's easy, especially when you're in this business, to have this sense that the world is sort of, going to hell, right? When your business is working at Human Rights Watch, for example, and your beat is focusing on atrocities and the bad things that people do to each other, that really colors your view on the world. But it's a helpful perspective to sort of stand back and to know that since the end of the Cold War, the number of wars and the deadliness of wars is actually decreasing. And that is a really interesting thing. Why is that happening? It's one of those things that hasn't really been studied enough. You know, the causal mechanisms are not totally clear. I mean, at least part of the reason is that we have media, we have civil society, we have governments, we have the United Nations that are intervening, that are working on these conflict situations. And so, you know, maybe that's a small sign of hope that things can get better. Things, you know, it doesn't have to be, yes, genocides have always happened. We'll probably have other genocides. But, you know, if the number of conflicts and the deadliness of those conflicts is going down, surely that means that we as a species are doing something right. We need to figure out what that is and keep doing more of it. Well, we have about 40 minutes then for Q&A, and we have a couple of roving mics. So I just ask you to keep your question brief, and please make it a question. I'm actually going to prioritize at the outset students who are here before turning things over to the larger public, just because sometimes the students are bashful and they don't raise their hand and they don't get asked their question.
Thank you, Professor Sharp. Thank you all panelists for coming here and sharing with us your perspective stories. I was particularly interested in the role of the survivor story in generating movement and creating a dialogue in the international community. I've done some work with a local hospital up in North County, working with survivors of brain injury patients doing, trying to get them re-engaged in the communities, getting them re-engaged in policies and events that are going on, current events that are happening in the world. And I wanted to ask the panelists, what are some tools and tactics that you have utilized or think that we can utilize to insert their narrative back into public policy?
I'm not a politics question. Sorry. I think I was still talking artistic power safety because that's what I do. I think for survivors in engaging in conversation, it's also a healing process. It's because you need to understand. We are always looking for answers, and we can't find those answers, and we are keeping looking. Isn't that looking that you engage, you want to know, how other people think, why did this happen, especially for young people. For us, it's more about looking for answers, and then in looking for those answers, you want everyone to contribute and tell a story. And the other thing, I think there haven't been so much of counseling. I think the only counselor I know in Rwanda who is very famous worked with many survivors. It's one person. I don't know anyone else. So people in the process of getting out of that trauma, it's also that people need to share. They need to talk about those stories. For this recently, before I came here, we had this national program we did. It was called I have an association I'm part of called Art for Peace. We thought about bringing the young generation between 20 and 40 to have a conversation. It was called Youth Dialogue. Where are we? How are we moving forward? Without excluding anyone, survivors, children from perpetrators, can we sit and have a conversation? And it was more focusing on how is the life of those young people who have parents in prison? Because some people didn't still say that they did the right thing to kill. And that kid have to take food to their parent every Friday. They have both sides of the story. They have their parent in prison telling them we did the right thing. They have the government telling them they are wrong, you have to move forward, you have to be creative, entrepreneurship. And they have the society they live in. Everyone sees them in the image of their parent. And we wanted to create a safe space for those people. And we were lucky to be supported by the First Lady. And we toured, when I came, we had already done 15 districts out of 30. And they're still doing the same work. And it was very successful. We would go and take famous musician. We first dance, everyone enjoy. And then we start talking. We hear testimony. And you find someone, everyone wants to talk. We would spend it, everyone has a story and they need someone to listen to, just only listening. So, that's what I can say. It's survivors engaging kind of personal healing and trying to understand. I think we will never understand, but at least it makes you keep moving on and leave. Yeah. Thank you.
Good. I just have a few more words to add to that. Rwanda has been very successful in dealing not just with survivors, but with perpetrators who've come back in the last few years from the bush in Congo. some who are members of an outfit called the FDLR, which is a rebel group still fighting the existing Rwandan government. They put them through a process of debriefing where they do group storytelling and they tell their stories. And then they split up, change the groups, they tell their stories again and again and again. And they eventually get to the point where they work through it. I've seen the same technique used in dealing with post-traumatic stress in the military, just retelling. The trick always is to find somebody who can hear you. So the stories seem to work best when they're told to an audience that can hear. And the last point, if you're looking for reference material on it, there has just been published a report from the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission dealing with First Nations experience of forced residential schooling.
Given the problems with the Gacaca courts protecting procedural rights for the accused, what would you... if you could turn back the clock, would you do the Gacaca courts again, or would you do something different, and what would that be for prosecutions?
As I said, it's hard to think of what else could have been done in Rwanda, to be honest. It was like I said, it was... an unprecedented and ambitious project, and it was done to a large extent in a remarkable way. But I think with the benefit of a hindsight, and actually not only with the benefit of a hindsight, but people were suggesting this at the time as well, you could have built a better review system into it. You know, because it's inherently in the nature of each data there would be a possibility of wrongful conviction. And it did happen, actually. And it was important to correct those wrongful convictions. And that did not happen in the way it needed to happen. And I think there is still a chance to do that, actually. So I think, you know, I don't know what else could have been done. And I don't know whether it would really be a wise idea not to have the Gacaca. And actually, it was a remarkable undertaking, to be honest. But perhaps a better review system could have reduced the unintended and undesirable consequences.
Thank you very much. My question is for Dita and Eugene. As a psychologist and as a alum of the program, Dita, when you were saying that there were very few therapists, I think poor Rwanda, you got many, many therapists thinking they could fix the problem from Europe, and I'm sure we also sent, but it was short-term. It was completely out of the cultural context. Even if you've done trauma work, I've done trauma work for almost 30 years working with abuse, and I don't think anybody was prepared. And I think they put band-aids on everybody and then they left and they said good luck. So I'm really delighted to hear that you're using art and you're using techniques that come from within the culture to connect people with the emotion that they have to feel and pass through, which leads to my other question. I know that Rwanda's received a lot of criticism for saying, no more Hutu, no more Tutsi, we're Rwandan. And I'm wondering if in the process of transitioning and reconciliation, that... Well, according to the NERC report in 2000, I think it came out in 2012, so they asked the citizens for 2 years, and there are questions about the report also, but the number one thing that came out was the concern really about is it possible to have another genocide? And if it were to happen, what would cause it? And the socioeconomic disparity between those who have and those who do not have, that's the biggest concern rather than ethnic issues. So my question is it really so necessary to deal with the Hutu Tutsi and to kind of rehash the ethnic part as it is to invest everything that Rwanda has into improving education, socioeconomic? Because if you take care of people's basic needs, then you move to a place, I think, where people can begin to be more comfortable talking about the conflict between, if you want to talk about conflict between groups. But I think it's really difficult to ever reach a place where it's safe to do that, literally, government-wise and just personal-wise, if you feel that there's so much, you know, some have and some don't have, socioeconomic. And the youth are in, a really tight spot right now. You know, you have educated youth who have no employment. So I guess it's a question for whomever knows, is there a push from an agricultural state to almost like shooting up to high tech immediately? Because there's not a lot of leeway in between. And I'm thinking, you know, if you became sort of another India or Pakistan who has lots of high tech computer, that sort of a thing, you don't need a lot of land for that. So as a way, that's a form of reconciliation between people. That's
If I can go first, I think the ethnicity thing and social classes—it's not that we are only like the whole country is only dealing with ethnicity issues. There are a lot other many things going on being done. That's a part of what the society needs to move on. That's part of, and we should think that this is 20 years ago. It's not 50. There is always issues, and we can't reach a high scale. I think we've really done a lot. And not having the ethnicity, I think, for me, I think it's a very good thing, because now half of the population, almost a half, is under 20. And the parents still talks about it, and people who learned an ideology for 30 years, you can't just remove it from them. But slowly, the more young people feel themselves as Rwandese, not as a Hutu or Tutsi, it's a very good thing. When I go out, I don't start looking at people's nose, and I see someone I can do business with, someone who's nice or not nice, not other thing. Even for me, who's a survivor, should be going around saying, maybe his father is a killer. No, I don't do that anymore. You get at a point that doesn't matter. And also then going to the economic thing, that also helps in removing those ethnicity, because people want to work for tomorrow. People need to eat. And the economy is very bad these days, so you won't waste your time in other issues than working. And the difference in social classes, which can cause another genocide, I don't think so. We're a developing country, and in all countries, you all here have poor and rich and middle classes. I think people should see us not as we have to do miracles. We are just moving slowly, and we'll get there. We'll get there, and we can't wake up in the morning and remove all the poverty. It's not possible. It's a process, and it's a long process, and which is possible. I think that's what I can say.
On the question of the Hutu and Tutsi, there are even Twa who are rarely mentioned. There is really nothing wrong with identifying yourself with your ethnic or community group. But the most important thing is, what value does that add to my being with my neighbors and to my life? and to my way of living. I think I should correct this. There was no official policy to avoid the ethnicity issue in Rwanda. To the best of my knowledge, in the last 20 years I've been in Rwanda, there's nothing official saying that you shouldn't mention Tutsi or Hutu or Twa. If really some people feel that it's a factor that should be included in the development dimension, then at some point we shall have to think about another fourth ethnic group coming out of the marriages between the Hutu and Tutsi. Regarding reliance on agriculture, definitely we are not, when I say we, I'm talking of Rwandans, we're not going to be relying on land in the next few years. You can imagine many people died during genocide, but by 2012 statistics, the population of Rwanda is 11.4 million people and counting. And Rwanda is very small. I would say very small. I don't have the exact figure, but you would check it and divide the number of those millions of people on the square miles of land. There is a deliberate effort to invest in human capital development, and this is engineered towards technology, IT, ICT, and mainly investing in education of our human capacities. So the future is on building individuals' skills and probably through education and probably selling those skills to people who need them in exchange for some things which we don't have. That's all I can say about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I was interested that no one mentioned the Convention Against Genocide, one of the few treaties that the United States has ratified and is a state party to it. And some say that the refusal of Tony Lake and the Clinton administration, for which I believe Bill Clinton later apologized to give him credit, but they didn't want to acknowledge the genocide because then they would have to fulfill the requirements of the convention. So do you think the Convention Against Genocide is now a dead letter? Or is there something we can do to revive it? This is a question for anyone.
It's a good question for Daniel.
Yeah, I guess it also seems to me that why the Clinton administration at the time did not want to acknowledge was because if they acknowledge there is a responsibility. There is a responsibility to act. There is a responsibility to respond. So I guess that's one of the reasons why the administration at the time refused to recognize it as a genocide. So that is, not only just with the U.S. government, but with the international community in general, it was such a shameful failure, in spite of a lot of voices alerting to the situation. But I think it does not really make the Genocide Convention a dead letter. I think it's still very much a live letter. It's still an important instrument. It's still a very useful and powerful tool. I think the problem is more with the intergovernmental agencies and the countries with the means in responding to situations, you know. So, such as the United Nations, the Security Council, the African Union, and other intergovernmental bodies, and countries with the capacity and the means. So, you know, I think at least after the this experience, we have you know, an articulation of principles like the right to protect, which is one lesson out of this exercise, but it is still a challenge to the extent to which it is working or not working. At least we have the International Criminal Court established since then, which is one positive step forward in terms of creating relevant bodies. But I think the challenge remains in the political will and commitment to live up to the principles and responsibilities that are embodied in the relevant international instruments. So I think there is a lot more to be desired, and there is a lot more to be done for governments and intergovernmental institutions to live up to the principles embodied in these instruments. But the instruments themselves are very much live documents for me.
I'm from the School of Leadership and Education, so my question's a little bit different. How do we educate the youth, like way youth, K through 6, on travesties around the world in a friendly way that's beyond treat your friends equally? How do we inform them of events like this, maybe not genocide specifically, but encourage peace nationwide and worldwide?
I might say something just quickly to that, because it was interesting when I moved to Rwanda, my kids were so young, and we talked about how much do we tell them. I mean, it's hard enough for adults to wrap their mind. Oh, I'm sorry. you know, it's hard enough for adults to wrap their mind around it. So we didn't really tell them the details of it. They went to school while they were there, where they touched on some of it, but again, it's all age appropriate. And I think for me, I mean, a big part of what I've come to see is whether it's the genocide in Rwanda or, you know, other genocides or other conflicts, where it really amounts to teaching hate. I mean, in Rwanda, this was like planned, and there was years of literally teaching hate over the radio. And it doesn't always happen to that degree. But we see it at all kinds of places where, you know, we're divided by our differences, and it's used for either political reasons. It happens even here in this country to some degree. And so for me, it's talking to my kids about how much we're alike as opposed to how we're different. And being able to recognize when somebody's trying to divide you for their own purposes and turn you against, you know, and think for yourself, is that really how you want to? So I think it breaks it down into more simple human interaction with kids. It's only been more recently that we've told our kids some more details, and partly because they are so close to Dita, just like we would tell them any other friend who'd been through a difficult time. They have some sense of now of what happened, but I think it has to be age appropriate, but I think there's some basic lessons that you can teach kids, you know, to see when there starts to be that sort of people leaning towards teaching you to hate someone just because they're different.
Can I?
Or fear somebody.
Well, and I think that's a big part of it, is using fear. Yeah.
I like your question. It's very important. One of the areas where Rwanda needs a lot of improvement is within education system. All those efforts geared towards helping the youth reconcile and understand what happened, they have been within the hands of the youth themselves. Government has come in, government bodies have come in to support the youth, but there hasn't been really a very clear education policy to kind of streamline that, mainstream that. So what is missing is that genocide, what happened, peace building, conflict management, is not taught in schools. And this is something that should be taught. This is something that should be introduced in schools from primary school or even before that. Teaching young kids about genocide and prevention of genocide is not so bad, because within their families, some family members teach them hate the Tutsi, hate the Hutu. So if you can teach them in school, love the Tutsi, love the Hutu, love your neighbor, prevent genocide in the future, it would be a long way to propel Rwanda into a prosperous future.
Two-part question. I'd love to hear a couple responses. What is one thing that you hope the world never forgets about the genocide? And how can we use that remembrance as an international community to create a better today and a better tomorrow?
Do you want me? For me, I would say one thing I would like to see the world remembering or not forgetting about the genocide is like I just said, the failure to prevent it, because it could have been prevented and it could have been stopped. And that's one thing I think we should always be remembering. And this is a live reality today as we speak. When you look at what's happening in Central African Republic, what's happening in South Sudan, you wonder whether we have really learned a lesson and whether we really have resolved to prevent atrocities from happening again. So I think that's one important thing the world has to continue to remember, that it has shamefully failed humanity in a big way. And I think it is something that can be changed with intergovernmental agencies and governments responding in a timely fashion, but at the same time also in addressing the root causes of such problems, the governance crisis, is the world properly addressing and responding to the governance crisis, the human rights crisis, the poverty crisis, which is perhaps at the root of such atrocities. So there is a lot more that can be done, and the world has the capacity and the means to do it and to make a difference. But unfortunately, we are not doing it, and I think we need to do more, I guess.
I'd like the world to reflect upon and remember the terrible consequences of fear left unchecked. Fear and weakness, they breed resentment and they open up a society to the kinds of manipulation that make genocides possible.
I would add to that just a story that I remember reading at the Genocide Museum that I think illustrates how that fear and hatred can be created, and that I think we need to be more alert to when we see that being happening. There was a young man's story who, he was Hutu, and he heard, for this long period of time, over a year, 2 years, the propaganda on the radio about fearing the Tutsis, and they were going to come and kill them, so the Hutu needed to be prepared to protect themselves. And so he believed that, and he built a pit in his yard, and his plan was to hide the rest of his Hutu family when the Tutsis came for them, which is what they were being told. They should fear the Tutsis. When the genocide happened, it became immediately clear to him that it was all a lie, that it was, in fact, the other way around. And the first thing he did was to try to find as many of his Tutsi neighbors as he could and hide them. So this was clearly a man that did not have that innate hate. He did not have, but that fear was created in him, and he believed it. And so many people acted on that. So I think some of the precursors to something like this is that creation of fear and hatred, and I think we can be more aware of that and not brush it off as might in some cases, oh, it's minor. It's, you know what, that's the building block to starting to dehumanize other people and starting to fear them. They convinced millions of people to turn against their neighbors, most of whom never would have normally done that.
For me, I think why we should remember is to give a name to those people, because we are not all born to die as they died. And it's not even only in Rwanda. It's to give a name to all those people, victim of violence everywhere, and reflect, it make us reflect about humanism. What is a human being if we can let another human die in that way? Then, yeah, I think it gives us a sense of valuing, give the value to a human being. And also, I always say that it's always sad for me to think about all the children in Sudan, all the children in Central Africa. I imagine, where would they be in 20 years or 30 years? Would they be able to overcome all things they're going through? And I think also that gives me the courage to remember those people and help the others who've been through that to move on. It's very necessary. It's and also keeping for mostly for the survivors. It's for us to keep to even deeper and find the good memories of those people. Why should we always, like for me, I only had the bad memory, but talking with my sister, I just start getting those new other good memories of those people, so I won't spend my whole life crying. And yeah, it's a lot of things. Yeah.
If out of more than 100 U.S. universities could do what USD did today, your representatives, congressmen and congresswomen, who some of them will be members of the UN management system, they would stand up and listen and say, these are universities, these are institutions of education, they have information, they are standing up. If it could be done on a large scale, in these remaining days, we have 100 days of remembrance, if it could be done, it could stick to the memory of people who make decisions in the world. And the chances of this happening again would be minimized in the future.
Thank you. So I think that's a really great note to end on. I know there were still a lot of hands out there, but in a moment, I would encourage you to mob the panelists with any questions you have that didn't get answered. And I'm going to turn things over to Derek.
So my name is Derek Cartwright, and I'm the director of University Galleries. And it's my role at this point to send you all home. But I will do that by thanking everyone here, thanking this audience, thanking this panel for this really powerful exchange of ideas based in experience and knowledge. And for right now, I'd like to thank this audience for your questions. I'd like to thank Dita and Eugene and Daniel and Philip and Paige and Dustin for sharing their thoughts with us all. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.